The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and/or your understanding. Good evening. My name is Bonnie N., and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Head of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers, followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note that you will be given 5-minute and 1-minute reminders when it is time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker is Donna D.
Hi, Donna Alcoholic. I'm happy to be here tonight. I'll get a couple statistics out of the way. My sobriety date is March 1st, 2012. My sponsor is Kimberly K, and the Pacific Group is my home group. And I'm just going to start by telling you a little funny story, and I'm going to tell on myself. You know, I have been dreading getting called to do, asked to do 10 minutes at Wednesday night since I came into the rooms. When I got here, I was so self-centered and so self-obsessed that I went to go listen to my first sponsor, Lydia W., and I couldn't even say they asked me to read the 12 traditions, and I couldn't even do it. I started crying, and I couldn't do it, you know, in my first couple of weeks. I've always been so concerned about how you think of me, right? I've never feel like I'm pretty enough. I'm not funny enough. I'm going to say something stupid. I'm not wearing the right clothes. You know, that's how I came to you guys. And so yesterday, when I got the call to call Marty, I was like, oh my gosh, it's finally happened. And I feel like I jinxed myself, right? Because I was sitting down the other night writing out Christmas cards because, you know, it's the pandemic. We got to lean in, right? I miss you guys terribly. I miss being in regular meetings. So I thought, you know what? I am going to send Christmas cards out this year. And Marty, I love you, but I made a decision to not send Marty a card because I didn't want to draw attention to myself. And I don't send a card to Marty. And here I get a call. And here I am, your 10-minute speaker tonight. So, and then to make matters worse, today at 10:30 this morning, the power went out in my house. And so we have no power. So I had to dig a generator out of the garage, which I don't know how to do this, right? So I have internet, my computer, and a little lamp in front of me that's running off of a generator. So anyways, here I am. I'm going to quickly get into, I know I don't have much time, so I'm going to quickly get into it. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. When I came to you guys in 2010, I had no tools for living. I couldn't do anything without a drink. Just to give you a quick glimpse of when I got here, I was drinking, my drink of choice is vodka because I can drink it in anything, or I can wave a little bit of Diet Coke over it. I was drinking a big handle of vodka every 2 days. If I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking, and I drank 24/7, and I had a full-time job, and it became a full-time job to just stay even, you know, to just not be too drunk at work, but to not be shaking. I was doing things like I didn't eat rice anymore because I would be too shaky to hold a spoon or a fork. I didn't take the stairs at work anymore because my legs were so shaky because I was so physically addicted to the alcohol when I got here. I couldn't go to the movies without alcohol. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't go on a date. I couldn't do anything without a drink because I needed to not feel so uncomfortable. And, you know, it got to be where I was drinking at work. You know, I would allow myself, you know, try to control and enjoy my drinking, right? I would try to, just at the top of the hour, I could take a big swig of a Gatorade that I had half full of vodka, you know, just to try to stay even. And, you know, when I got here, when I decided in October of 2011, that, you know, I just couldn't stop. I, like a lot of you guys, I looked at myself in the mirror and I was like, why can't you stop? You're so stupid. Like, just stop, you know? And I couldn't. And when I came to AA, I like to say that I jumped in with one foot, you know? I was going to meetings. I had a sponsor. I had commitments. And I stopped drinking for about a week. And I couldn't sleep. And I thought, I'm just going to drink one night. And then I'll get right back to it, right? I just want to sleep one night. And that turned into 5 months of drinking, right? Thank God for the app that tells you your sobriety date, because I was not drinking during the day, but I would come to meetings, do my commitment, and I would stop at the liquor store on the way home, get a little bottle of vodka, drink it. And I did that for 5 months. And, you know, I finally ended up going to treatment in March of 2012, and I finally had to surrender. I finally had to know that I had to just get serious about sobriety, that I couldn't do it by myself. You know, I had to really get in here with two feet, and I was kind of doing what you guys were doing, but I wasn't being honest. You know, I was drinking, and then I felt shame because I was drinking. And, you know, I really just had to surrender. I had a hard time when I first got here too, because I knew that I was powerless over alcohol, but I didn't see my life as unmanageable. And I was absolutely out of control, right? Like, I was emotionally bankrupt when I got here. And, I had all those yets, right? Like, I never got a DUI. I never went to jail. I never lost my job. I never lost my house, right? My family didn't really say anything to me. So I didn't really see myself as, you know, I knew that I couldn't stop drinking, but I didn't see the unmanageability until I really got sober, you know? And once I really got serious about it and really got some traction and got some days under my belt, you know, the promises started to come to life, right? I got a sponsor. I changed sponsors a couple of times, but I started working the steps. I started, you know, praying to a God. I started, you know, I got really active when I first got here to AA. You know, I was involved in the plays. I tried to, you know, I always got taught to lean in, right? Lean in when things get hard, right? And 2020 has been hard, right? I've had a lot of stuff this year, and I've never thought about taking a drink, right? I ended a 6-year relationship in March. I moved. I'm living with my mom now, helping take care of my mom. My job got changed. My mom had a stroke. You know, it's like all this stuff that happens, and, you know, I'm still sober. I don't have to pick up a drink, right? I have the tools now. I know what to do. For the most part, my head is quiet and my stomach is calm most of the time. I don't like to be in that crazy that I used to be. That used to be normal to me. And now peace and serenity is the norm. And if I'm not in that, I start picking up every tool that I've learned here. You know, I start making phone calls and I try to be of service, and I, you know, I try to get out of myself, try to make some phone calls. And, you know, leaning in during the pandemic has been one of those things that's been hard for me. You know, I'm used to going to more meetings, getting involved in one of the plays, you know, just doing different things. And we can't do that right now. But what I've been doing is going to more meetings, right? Going to more Zoom meetings. My sponsor, Kimberly, has a daily meeting at 9 o'clock, and I try to get to that meeting as many days as I can. You know, it's a small little group of like 25 women, and it's helped me tremendously. You know, I don't know if I would have been, I would have been freaked out sharing in front of you guys, even a year ago, you know, and just doing some of the things that I've been doing, this year have really helped me, you know. I pray and I meditate, you know, not perfectly, but I do it. And I know that that starts my day off right. Right. I pray to God to ask him to, you know, make me be the best person I can be and to help me stay sober. And I try to thank him at night. And, you know, I just try each day to be a little bit better version of me than I was the day before. You know, I don't know what my life would be like if I didn't have Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm one of those people that when I got here, I hated hearing people say, I'm a grateful alcoholic. But you know what? Today, I'm a grateful alcoholic because I wouldn't have the life that I have today if I didn't have you guys, if I didn't have the tools, if I didn't stay sober. You know, I miss you guys. I miss my commitments. I miss seeing you guys in person. But, you know, we're doing what we have to do right now. We're resourceful, right? We're resilient, and we just keep trudging. And if you're new, please stay. I know it's hard in a pandemic. I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have a place to, you know, physically go to. I think that helped me so much. But I just want to say I miss you guys all. I hope you have a great holiday. I love you. And thanks for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Donna, especially during a power outage. Lack of power is our dilemma. So our second 10-minute speaker is Patrick S.
Hi, everybody. Patrick Stewart, alcoholic. Donna, what a great share. I love you. I miss you guys so much. I can't even tell you. You know, it's been a rough couple of days, and I must salute Marty because he would know that, you know, there's a place of sorrow that only talking about yourself for 10 minutes can possibly touch. So thank you for that, Marty. It was great to see Dwight. I love you, Dwight. Dwight was the best man at my wedding. He's the godfather of my oldest son. I remember when Graham was born and I asked him to be the godfather, he goes, does that mean I have to put him through college? And I said, yes, Dwight, that is what that means. But he still said yes, so I'm grateful for that. You know, I was maladjusted to life right out of the gate. My great-grandparents were alcoholic swingers from Belfast. My grandfather died in his early 40s. He proposed to his wife with a handgun. My mother, God bless her, she keeps gin in the bathroom, and we just tell everybody it's for cleaning purposes. And then there's me. I came right out. The earliest memories I have are of not having the instruction manual, of not understanding how to do this. And everybody else seemed, it looked like everybody else had it going on. And on top of it, they seemed to be judging me for not having what they have, for not having life skills. And I was a violent little kid. I was just, I was angry, and I was just a little basket case. And I've heard it said that I was a scream looking for a mouth. And I get that. I know that feeling. And my father was in show business in the 60s. He was part of the British invasion. He was part of the folk movement, and he had seven top 40 hits in the mid 60s. And usually people come up to me after the meeting and go, is your dad Rod Stewart? So I don't usually tell people who my father is, but I will tonight. I mean, I don't think it's a good idea to drop names. You know who told me that? Larry Hagman. Newcomer, by the way, that's called being cute. And just because I tried it at 25 years of sobriety doesn't mean you should try it. My father was Chad Stewart of a group called Chad and Jeremy in the 60s. And it was kind of a big deal. He raised me to be a musician, but I watched the trumpets fade for him. I watched the band break up. I watched the circus leave town, and that was not pretty. Anybody who's seen the Bee Gees thing on Netflix knows what I'm talking about. And but I went and I lived with my dad when we were little, and the marriage broke up. And my father was like Peter Pan, you know, he's a musician. I was practically I was his roommate. And you know, I remember when I was 5 or 6 living in Malibu with my dad, and I told him I wanted a pack of cigarettes, and he goes, well, all right, but you got to smoke the whole pack. And there I am in, you know, the Malibu, you know, bathroom of our house, just smoking in the mirror. And then I go next door to Eric's house. He's 5, and I knock on the door, and his mother answers the door, and I go, can Eric play? And she looked at me and she said, yes. And would you like an ashtray? I mean, I was like a wolf boy. I was raising myself because my father was always in the studio. And occasionally I would get to go to see my dad in the studio, and I would go to sleep with my head on the pillow and the kick drum, his drummer's kick drum. And I just remember the smell of magnetic tape and guitar cases will always remind me of my father. And, but I, you know, jump cut, by the time I was, I decided not to go into music, and I went into something secure like television. And by the time I was in my early 20s, I was living in New York and I was working on a soap opera. And I was living like a complete basket case. I mean, my apartment, you wouldn't board an animal in my apartment. I had no life skills, you know. And I remember thinking, I was drunk. I was just getting, it got to the point in my early 20s where I was drunk all the time. The first time I had gotten drunk was when my dad, the musician, didn't show up for my graduation from junior high school. And that's my first drunk was at somebody. It was based on a resentment. I drank at my father. And my father was continuously letting me down throughout my life. And it just made sense. So by the time I was in my early 20s, I was drinking all the time. I'm living in this apartment in New York. I tear up the tile in the bathroom to the subfloor because I'm thinking I'm going to redo my apartment or something. And the cockroaches are coming in, and I'm throwing them in the microwave one at a time to serve as a warning to the other cockroaches, because that's the level of sanity that I was functioning on. And I lost the job because I was crazy, and I was just staying in my apartment. And I've heard it said that, you know, I was drinking every day, and I just watched the lights go flashing out the window, and they were days going by. And my mother would send steaks, you know, because she couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And you know, eventually I found myself wandering through Riverside Park. I was just so despondent. It was just such a yellow loneliness. And I ran into an Al-Anon who's still a friend of mine today. And she said, I think you should try Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember thinking she could not be more wrong, because it's when I stop drinking that the problem really kicks in. I can't stop drinking. I can't live without alcohol, but I was willing to check it out. I went to Fireside on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, 90 meetings in 90 days, didn't crack a big book, didn't get a sponsor, but I shared constantly. I would have shared twice a meeting if you'd let me. Old timers' eyes were rolling in the back of their heads. I was that guy, but I did manage to get a 90-day chip, and I moved to Los Angeles, and I pronounced myself cured. And by the time I had torched a relationship and gone out again, I came crawling in to 26th and Broadway, and a man named Steve Tom found me, and he said, you're new, aren't you? And I was about 50 pounds lighter than I am now, and I'm smoldering, you know, and I said, I don't know how you did that. How do you know I'm new? He says, you got a sponsor? I said, no. He says, you do now. Call me every day. He took me to the Pacific Group, and he made me get commitments at all the meetings. And, you know, it was like Scott Redmond said, I caught alcoholism. It's a funny thing about alcoholism. If you don't catch it, it'll kill you. But if you do catch it, there's hope. And he had me doing all the, he said, I want you to do something for somebody, and I don't want you to, for any accolades, I don't want you to get any credit for it. So I broke into my ex-girlfriend's house and I cleaned it. You know, trust God, clean house. Right. And Dwight, of all people, was the one who told me when I was counting days. He goes, have you told that to your sponsor? I said, no, Dwight, I don't want any credit for it. And he says, that's the kind of thing you may want to tell your sponsor. And of course, Steve looks down like this and he goes, that's not service. That's breaking and entering. And we don't do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had to get a new sponsor at 1 year because Steve didn't have as much time as he claimed he did. And I went with Steve Watson. Steve Watson said, well, where are we in the steps? I said, well, I guess we're making amends. And he had me making financial amends, and he had me going to restaurants that I'd stolen from, and he had me going to all sorts of places and making amends. And the amazing thing is, around that time, my father called. He was living in Sun Valley, Idaho, had been for many, many years. And he said, I had had a resentment against him. And I think I've remembered it being 10 years, but the truth is, I think I hadn't spoken to him for 4 years. And he said, your brothers and sisters are getting old and they don't know you. Are you willing to come up to Sun Valley? And I hated the tone. And I said, no, I'm busy. And he says, well, can you come up for Christmas? And I said, no, Dad, I'm busy. And I hung up the phone and I called Steve. And you know what he said. He said, well, it looks like somebody's going to Sun Valley, Idaho. And this is the point where I don't want to cry like Greg Day. But because there is no humiliation like that. I went to Sun Valley, Idaho against my better judgment. And Steve Watson, he talked me into that. And My father was quivering. He was so excited to see me when he met the plane. And we went for a hike and we had dinner. And after dinner, I said to him, I said, I'm sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think it's time that I tell you that I've been holding a grudge for things maybe real, but mostly imagined. And if you'll have me back in your life, I'd like to be your son again. And I got my dad back. And more importantly, PG, my dad got his son back. And for the last 24 years, I've gone up to Sun Valley, Idaho multiple times a year. I've brought him grandchildren. I've been a good son to that man. And he died 3 days ago. And the truth is that instantly, I was so filled with gratitude because I felt all of you. I felt the reward all at once. How easy it would have been to have missed this on my best judgment. You know, he's not here, you know, but I'm okay with that. We were good. We were good together. He died with my sister and my brother by his side, his wife with him, his dog at his feet. It was a good death. And I cannot tell you how grateful I am. I have been overpaid 10 times for what I've given Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything good in my life is a result of God, the Big Book, PG, and the steps. A newcomer, if you've heard nothing else tonight, remember to stay after the meeting for the Pacific Group Orchestra because it's awesome. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Patrick. Our main speaker tonight is Tim.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Tim Krueger, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here tonight and glad to be sober. I have been sober since November 16th, 1985. And for that, I'm most grateful. I want to thank Donna and Patrick for their talks. Although part of me is wondering if Marty put Donna up to that story just as a way to get more Christmas cards, but I don't know, I could be wrong. I really identify with Patrick's talk about his father. I had a very similar story, and it was very touching for me to hear that. I want to thank Marty for asking me to speak tonight. You know, this is the night that Vince Yeo used to speak every year, the Wednesday before Christmas. And, you know, Vince, you know, there may be a lot of people at the meeting this evening that never had an opportunity to meet Vince, but Vince was a member of our group, and he was always in the center of everything. And, you know, Vince directed shows, and he started the finance class, and he did a couples gathering. Vince helped a tremendous amount of people in our group over a long period of time. And he was my sponsor for almost 23 years. And, you know, Vince was one of those people in Alcoholics Anonymous who he just had an AA compass that always pointed true north. And he certainly had a tremendous impact on my life, even to this day. And so to have the chance to speak at this meeting every year just means a great deal to me. It's a special night. Although I do miss being at the synagogue, you know, this night at the synagogue with the anticipation of the holidays, with the PG orchestra looming after the meeting, I mean, the room was just electric. And I miss being with all of you, and I miss that environment, and I look forward to getting back to it. But, you know, I guess we're lucky that we have Zoom, that we can still be together despite the current circumstances with the pandemic. Although I have to admit, I'm still getting used to trying to speak at Zoom meetings. You know, it's a lot like talking to yourself. Which I actually have a great deal of experience at. You know, I'm not sure that qualifies as a skill necessarily, but I've done it a lot. In fact, some of the best AA talks I've ever given have been the ones I gave to myself. So maybe we'll get lucky tonight. I don't know. We'll see. You know, I've been a member of the Pacific Group for over 35 years now. Ever since I called Clancy, I think it was in December of 1985, and I went down to his office to meet with him, and he brought me to you. And, you know, that was a relationship, a friendship that I had with Clancy till he just passed away recently. And, you know, I just feel that I was very blessed to know Clancy as a man. to know his brilliance and his wit and his kindness, and to know his faults as well. And you know, he certainly has had an influence on my life, and similar to Vince, an influence that that lingers to this very day. You know, I've given a lot of thought to our group lately, and you know, when you think about it, we have been very blessed. We have had some of the most iconic and historic figures of Alcoholics Anonymous as members of our group. You know, these are people that have literally traveled the world to share their message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we got to sit next to them on Wednesday nights. And it really is remarkable when you think about it. You know, everything that I have in my life, everything that my life is made of today is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous and the Pacific Group. Because without that, you know, there's no difference between the man I am today and the man that literally almost drank himself to death, except for Alcoholics Anonymous and the Pacific Group. I grew up back east. My dad was a Lutheran minister. I had an older sister, Karen, and a younger sister, Kristen, who was afflicted with a severe handicap with severe cerebral palsy. And, you know, my mother was the prototypical preacher's wife. She relished the role and she did it fantastic. And she was just a wonderful, wonderful mother. And, you know, Christmas in our house was, you know, with my dad being a minister was obviously a very, very special time. You know, I was an acolyte and we sang in the choir and our house was filled with Christmas music. And my sisters and I did, you know, little plays in front of the fireplace for our parents. And we had an Advent wreath on our dinner table and we light the candles. And it was always something special that on Christmas Day, you got to light the Christmas candle in the center of that wreath. And that's what that life was like. And we were surrounded by, you know, grandparents and cousins and aunts and uncles. And it was just a really idyllic way, really, for a child to be raised. But everything changed when I was about 9 years old. You know, it turned out that my dad was a chronic alcoholic. You know, alcoholism doesn't really care who you are, where you come from, what your race is, what your sexual preference is. It doesn't matter. It can get any one of us. And my dad was a chronic alcoholic. And it finally caught up with him one night where my mother just didn't know what to do with him when I was about 9 years old. And so she called my best friend's father, Mr. Mahoney. And Mr. Mahoney came over and ended up in a fist fight with my dad in my bedroom. And, you know, when you're 9 years old and you see your dad fighting, you know, the father of your best friend, I mean, it was just a terrifying experience. And I saw my dad taken away in handcuffs. And, you know, I wasn't to see him again for many years after that. And there was something about that experience that that just changed our lives forever. And I don't know why that was, but, you know, shortly after that time period, my little sister got very sick with a terminal illness and she passed away. And then we seemed to lose just one family member after the other. And, you know, we just went through a series of tragic events and things that happened that really no child should ever have to go through. And, you know, we ended up, my mother just trying to raise us. I mean, we had no money. You know, my bedroom was either the living room couch or the day bed in the kitchen. And she struggled to take care of us. And you know, I'll tell you something, for many years, I kind of hid behind that. I looked at that as, because I knew there was something wrong with me and I didn't know what it was. And I kind of hid behind those feelings. It just, you know, was a result of, you know, the tragic things that had happened in my life, that, you know, life had imposed these things on me. And that I was just a victim of life circumstances. And I was just, you know, when you're a victim, you're not empowered to change anything in your life. And I had no sense of being able to take responsibility for anything in my life. I just hid behind that and used that as an excuse to watch my life kind of wither away. And, you know, it turns out that the feelings that I had were not a result of anything that happened to me in my childhood. You know, certainly when a child goes through traumatic experiences, you get affected by it. And I was affected by it, but I wasn't affected by it in the ways of that gave me the feelings that I was having. You know, I had feelings as far back as I can remember, of just being overly self-conscious, overly concerned about what other people thought of me, just being fearful and overly concerned about what other people thought of me. And just, I'd have these feelings of inadequacy and at the same time, just grandiose ideas of who I thought I was and what my life should become. And, you know, it was really a long time, really some time of being in Alcoholics Anonymous before I really got an understanding of really where those feelings come from. And it became clear to me in Alcoholics Anonymous that those feelings are the result of my ability to be virtually completely and totally self-centered. And it never seemed that way to me. You know, that's one of the insidious things about being self-centered. It's like, you're the last person to know. Everybody else knows, but you can't see it. You know, it seemed to me that I was always trying to please other people. And so it didn't feel like I was being self-centered, but that's what I was. It was really more a sense of being self-absorbed. You know, left to my own devices, I will literally think about how I feel every waking moment. And when I do that, I start to get anxious. And as I said, I get that fear and it causes me to withdraw. And when I withdraw, it just increases the intensity of those feelings and I get lost in them. And I'm trapped. I'm just kind of trapped in that world. And I become disconnected with the people around me, even the people that care about me the most. And when I get disconnected from them, I lose the sense of identification with other people. And I become lost. And my perception of reality is changed. And the way I look at life, it seems to make sense, but it seems to only make sense to me. And my perceptions are just a little bit off because of that inability to connect with other people. And it turns out that for whatever reason, when I drink alcohol, that whole dynamic changes. I go from that sense of isolation and loneliness and fearfulness. I take a drink and it goes away. Alcohol has that effect. Alcohol was never the problem. Alcohol was the solution to the problem. And the thing is I didn't, it's all very clear to me now, but it wasn't so clear to me then. I didn't realize any of this was going on. All I knew was that, you know, I had these overwhelming feelings and I was lonely, and when I drank, it was different. That's what I knew. And I like to feel good. It made me feel good, and so I drank a lot. You know, I have a very storied history, moved around a lot, done a lot of things, but one of the places that I ended up was Crested Butte, Colorado. And I'm telling this story at Robert Kilgore's behest, even though he doesn't even have his video on right now, but... I'm not judging Robert. But I ended up in Crested Butte, Colorado. And, you know, I got there in, I don't know, it was probably February, early March. And it was great. You know, it was everything. I felt like I had gotten cheated out of the 60s. And when I got to Crested Butte in 1981, it was like walking into the 60s. That's what it was like. And it was fun. It was a great time. And I enjoyed being there and, you know, I had a little job. I was making $5 an hour and it was enough to have my drinking money every night. And we were partying and carrying on and just having a grand old time. But what happens is they have what's called mud season in these ski areas. And that's what Crested Butte was, a ski resort. And when that happens, everybody leaves. Everybody just takes off. They've saved their money and they go to warm places. And, you know, I didn't save any money. I've never planned for anything. I mean, it was, you know, I lived one day at a time long before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I had no place to go. I didn't have an apartment or anything when I was there. I was just sleeping wherever anybody would let me sleep. And so a guy was nice enough to let me house sit when he was gone. And so my dog Blaze and I moved into this house and we were there for, you know, 4 or 5 weeks and it was great. It was really nice. But then this guy came back, he wanted his house back, which, you know, honestly irritated me a little bit. It was really inconvenient for me, but I had to go. And so then I started thinking, well, what am I going to do? And, you know, I was really into this idea of I really wanted to impress people with who I was. And I just didn't feel like a man. I wanted to do something that was manly, you know. And so I gave it a lot of thought. And, uh, And so I came up with this this idea that I was going to get a tarp and I was going to string it between a few trees and I was going to put some pine boughs underneath and that's where I was going to live. And so I was out one night with this woman, Darlene, and I wanted to impress her. And so I kind of set her up about, you know, she's like, well, where are you going to go? You know, I told her I had to leave and she said, where are you going to go? And I said, well, I'm going to live under this tarp. And she looked at me and, you know, she gave me one of those looks. And it's like, maybe you've had this experience as well. I've had it way too many times where, you know, you have this idea in your head and you can only kind of get through the first 25% of it, it seems like. And you mull it over and over and over again. But then as soon as you start to tell it to somebody else, you realize that this may not be that good an idea. And that's what I was going through. She said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm going to live under a tarp. And she said, you can't do that. She said, this is your 9,000 feet in the Rocky Mountains. She said, I'll tell you what. She said, I have a teepee and you can use it instead. So let me tell you something. When you're looking at living under a tarp, a teepee sounds really good. And I got excited about it. And I set that thing up next to the Slate River. And, you know, I thought I put shag carpeting in it. And, you know, I thought, you know, I'm going to catch fish out of that river and cook them over an open fire. And I'm going to eat brown rice and dig up dandelion roots. And, you know, the deer will come eat from my hand and I will befriend the bear. And, you know, I thought, you know, the women are just going to come flocking out to Tim's teepee. I was absolutely convinced of it. And, you know, it may surprise you, but it didn't exactly work that way. I didn't set the teepee up right. And it was like the rainiest summer in like a decade. And it literally just rained in the teepee every night. And it was cold, it was wet. And I just thought, God, you know, how did this happen? Why do things never work out for me? You know, I'm just a loser, you know, and just never realized that, you know, this idea that I was a loser was just another excuse. That's all it was. And, you know, I ended up getting out of the teepee after a while. And my drinking just got way out of control. And, you know, I was a blackout drinker. I don't remember a lot of drinking stories. You know, the combination of age and time and blacking out. I just don't remember many, but I do remember one that I want to share with you. And that is I had gotten into this idea of freezing my alcohol. And I don't know if you've ever done that or not, but, you know, if you take like vodka or whatever, you put it in the freezer, it gets all thick and cold. And, you know, when you wake up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon for that first drink, you know, it just goes down a lot smoother and comes back up smoother. And I had taken a bottle of 100 proof schnapps. I had put it in the freezer of this studio apartment where I was staying. And I came staggering home after a night of drinking. And I climbed into bed. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. And my head hit the pillow of the bed. And I thought, God, I thought about that schnapps. I thought, you know, I just need one more hit off that schnapps. And so I got up out of bed and I walked over to the freezer and I opened the door and I took that bottle out and I took the cap off the schnapps and I knocked back a hit. Put the cap back on, put it back in the freezer, stumbled back over to bed. And my head no sooner hit that pillow. And I thought, God, you know, I need another one. I need another one. And I got up out of bed and I walked back over to the freezer and I repeated the same thing I'd done before. And I put the bottle back and I walked back over to my bed and my head hit the pillow and I thought I need another one. And I don't know how many times I got up that night. It was probably literally 30 or 40 times that I got up. It was completely obsessive and it was compulsive. And you may ask, you know, well, why didn't I just bring the bottle to bed with me? Why did I keep getting up? And there's a good reason for it, because every time I walked over that freezer was the last time. That was the last time. But it never was until that bottle was gone. And there's nothing in this world, nothing that I care about, nobody that I love, nothing that matters to me that I wouldn't have sacrificed to walk that 30 feet over to that freezer and get to that schnapps. Nothing. And that's how I drank. When you drink like that, bad things happen to you, and they all happen to me. And I ended up in Southern California because, you know, when the going gets tough, tough guys go live with their mothers. And that's what I did. And it's a true story. I've sponsored a lot of them. We all end up going to live with our mothers. And shortly after I moved back to my mother's, I was 26 years old, and my liver completely shut down. And it shut down for one reason and one reason only. It was because I drank too much. And I was in the hospital for a few days, and I had a spiritual experience in that hospital. And it just, and literally in a flash, that complete compulsion and obsession to drink was lifted from me. See, I couldn't imagine this life without alcohol. Everything I did in my life was associated with taking a drink first. And yet I had this spiritual experience where that obsession and compulsion that literally was taking me down the path of drinking myself to death was lifted. And it was a spiritual experience. There's no other way to describe it. And I admire those of you who come to Alcoholics Anonymous seeking help. I never would have. I don't have that kind of character. I don't have that kind of courage. And, had that spiritual experience not happened that day, I wouldn't be here tonight. There's no question in my mind. And I went to AA boot camp up in Northern California, I like to call it, Gene D's place. And I was up there for 28 days and I came back down and I was really struggling. And that's when I called Clancy. And I came to you, and I was afraid that, everybody kept asking me at the meetings, you have a sponsor. And I couldn't ask anybody. I just didn't have it in me. I just didn't have any self-worth. I couldn't do it. And Tom Kay was kind enough to appoint himself my sponsor. And he gave me some very simple directions that seemed to absolutely have nothing to do with any of the problems I had in my life, like no place to live, no money, no job. But he gave me directions to call him every day and go to a meeting every night. And he told me to go get a job. And I did those things. And my life started to change. I started to be able to work these 12 steps. And here's the thing. I didn't realize I was working them. I couldn't understand what they were about. I just couldn't figure them out. I was so in the clouds. So I looked at them as this abstraction. I didn't realize that they were truly a plan for living. I didn't understand that. I was looking, it seemed like, God, there must be something more to it than that. But there really wasn't. And Tom sponsored me for the first year. And then he had moved away. And that's when I asked Vince to sponsor me. And I was working the steps, as I say, without realizing them. And I've come to understand, look, there's a lot of different ways to look at the steps. And I'm not saying that however I look at it is the right way or anything. One of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous is you get to build your program. But the way I've come to understand them is this, is that they are a path for living. I did talked at this meeting one time, and I read about how Bill wrote the 12 steps. And I don't really have time to tell the story tonight, but if you ever get the chance, there's an article that he wrote for The Grapevine where it describes it. And I came to understand the 12 steps as literally a checklist of things to live my life by, of things to do to stay sober and to change who I was as a man. And so that's how I've come to understand them. If I can do that, then I can free myself of that self-centeredness in a little bit, in small ways, incrementally over the years, and become a different man. And those things happen. These 12 steps are powerful tools. And thank God, you don't have to understand them perfectly to be able to work them and have your life transformed by them. And that's what happened to me. My life started to get better and better, and I started to just have incredible things happen in my life. But, there was something missing in my sobriety, and I didn't really know what it was, but I was just a little bit off. And the problem with being a little bit off is it's not a big deal at first, but as you walk down life's path, it becomes a bigger and bigger problem. And then one day you wake up and you realize, God, how did I get over here, and how the hell do I get back? And that's kind of where I was. I was at the beginning process of that. And what happened was I got a call from central office. I had been on the 12-step call list for many years. And I got a call from central office. And they said, there's this guy, Jim, will you give him a call? He wants to get sober. And it was about, I think it was like 10:30 on a Thursday night. And I gave Jim a call and we talked and he was drunk. And at the end of the conversation, I said, Jim, do you want to get sober? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, here's my home number, here's my office number, and here's my pager number. For those young people that are on, the pager is this little device that we used to live our lives by. Anyway, we hung up the phone and he said he would call me, and I went to work the next day and no call from Jim. And I went to a meeting that night and I hadn't got to receive a call from Jim. And I thought, well, of course he didn't call. I just never seemed to be good at working with newcomers. And it seemed to be that there were people in AA that were good at it and people that weren't. And I'm one of the ones, and just couldn't do it. And I got home from the meeting at 10:30, my home phone rings and it's Jim. And we have the same conversation we had the night before, except this time I, I asked him for his address and he gave it to me. And I told him I'd be over the next night to pick him up for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the next night I went over, it was a Saturday night. I went to his house and, small house in Culver City, and I knocked on the door and his dad let me in and just turned around and walked away and pointed to their living room. And you could just feel how the disease of alcoholism had ripped through this family. Jim was a young man, 21, 22 years old. I walked into that living room and it was dimly lit. It was a small room with like red crushed velvet furniture and fringe hanging down from the lamps. And, but the most startling feature of the room is that his mother collected dolls. And there were shelves, floor to ceiling on every wall in that room, and every flat surface, there was a doll. And, I know like little girls like playing with dolls and stuff, but let me tell you something. When you walk into a room like that, it is creepy. And I thought, my God, what am I doing here? And I sat down in a chair and there was Jim sitting across from me in this big overstuffed chair. And he had a pair of overalls and no shirt, and his pant leg was ripped down from his hip. And there's dried blood running down his leg. And he had a black eye and a swollen nose and a fat lip, and his tooth was chipped. And he had taken a razor blade and he carved up his arms, hundreds of cuts up and down his arms. And he later told me he did that because he wanted people to think he was crazy. And that worked. I looked at him and he's looking at me expectantly. And I thought, what am I going to say? And so I just looked at him and I said, how you doing? Really profound. If you're looking for, the secret to talking to a newcomer, that happens to be it. You just walk up to him and you go, hey, how's it going? For whatever reason, that escaped me. Anyway, he looked at me and not surprisingly, he said, not too good. So I got him cleaned up and I took him to the Saturday night meeting, and I took him to a meeting every night that week because, I wanted Jim to stay sober. And I had told him all the directions that I was given, and he was doing good. He was calling me every day and he got a job and everything was going well. He was going to a meeting every night. And after about 45 or 50 days, the phone rang on a Saturday, and it was his mother, Jim's mother. And she said, I'm calling to tell you that Jim's drunk. And I said, okay. And I drove over to his house. And, I thought, how dare he get drunk? That son of a bitch. I mean, I really went to an effort here. This was inconvenient for me. How dare you get drunk, I got there and I knocked on the door and they let me in and they pointed me down the hallway to his bedroom. And I walked in that room and just, I stopped dead in my tracks because there was Jim and he was laying on the floor. This old woolen blanket just wrapped tightly around him. And he was laying there in his own urine and his own vomit. And there was an empty bottle of Thunderbird, empty, laying there tipped over next to him. And Jim was passed out drunk. And I looked at him and I thought, that's me. That's me. And it came crashing down on me in that very instant that that's what this is about. That's why we're on the Zoom meeting on a Wednesday evening. It's so that maybe we can get through one more day without taking a drink. And that's it. That's it. What a remarkable thing that is, that we have that reference point. It truly is incredible that we have that reference point that we share. Because the truth is that for someone like me, if I didn't take a drink today, no matter what else happens, it was a hell of a day. And it's easy to lose sight of that sometimes. I have sponsor guys and I got kids and I got a job and a family and I got all this stuff going on. It's easy to lose sight of that one simple core principle. But losing sight of it doesn't make it any less true. It's the thing that binds us together. It's the thing that makes us work. It's simple and it's powerful and it's incredibly reassuring. For years I talked and I think mistakenly gave this impression that, I drank and then all, kind of went through all this stuff and then a spiritual experience and everything was great. And that's not what's happened at all. I've certainly had my challenges. I've grieved. I've lost people that I love. Nancy and I have worked through marriage issues. We've had problem with our children. I've had my share of failures and disappointments and broken dreams. Sometimes life just gets in the way of dreams. I've made my share of mistakes, and I make them still today. And there are still times. It's not as often as it used to be, but there are still times where I wake up in the morning and I'm full of fear, and I have that sense of impending doom, and I don't know why. But if you were to take a step back and look at my life from a 40,000 foot view, this is what you would see. I wake up most days and I'm calm. And I feel self-assured and I'm happy. And Nancy and I have been together for over 35 years now, and we've been married for over 32 years of those. And we're going into kind of this new chapter in our life, and I'm excited about it. We share a lot of the same hopes and the same dreams, and I'm looking forward to the years ahead. And she and I have raised these three children. They're not children anymore. Our oldest daughter, Kristen, was valedictorian of her high school class. She went to Princeton University. She graduated Phi Beta Kappa and summa cum laude. She got a fellowship called Scholars in Our Nation's Service Initiative and got a master's from Princeton through that. And she has a job now there. She's working in the educational field where, you know, she's pursuing her passion of trying to make a difference for children. And she's married to David, and they live in Atwater Village, and they have a happy and successful life. And our son, Jack, is a professional baseball player, which is just a thrill for his mother and I. And, but Jack is way more than a baseball player. He's faced his share of adversity, and he's looked it dead in the eye, and he hasn't backed away from it, and he's overcome it with courage. And he is getting married in a few weeks at our house here in Durango to Mackenzie, and we welcome her into our family. And our youngest daughter, Caitlin, graduated from the University of Pittsburgh with an engineering degree this past spring. She graduated virtually, and she has an amazing job, and she's working virtually as well. So she's so excited to be living with her parents, but that's the way it is for now. And she is an incredible person, and it's just been such a gift to have her around and have her with us. And I tell you these stories about my kids for two reasons. One is that it's a way for me to honor my wife, because she's not in the program. And there were many nights where I was walking out the door and those kids were hanging on my leg, and they were screaming. And she took those children and she fed them and she bathed them and she did their homework with them and she read books to them. And it was all done very selflessly without any recognition and a great sacrifice. And I think you would all agree that she did a remarkable job with those kids. And the other reason I tell you about that is think of a more powerful description of how Alcoholics Anonymous works than those three kids. Because remember, I'm the guy with the schnapps. I'm the guy with the schnapps. And if you're wondering, are there really miracles in Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, look around on the Zoom call and you'll see my wife and you'll see those children and you'll know that they're there because you'll see them. You know, I went through a long period of time around here not understanding things about like God and love and all that. You know, I suffered from this whole thing with my dad and the church, and you know, you just don't talk about love where I come from. And then I realized at one point, you know, when I came here to the Pacific Group, I had nothing. I had no place to go, no place to live, no money. And Jim H. and Dave M. took me into their home and they let me sleep on their couch. And they didn't even know my last name. And I think of the countless times that old timers took a few minutes to talk to me at the yard or at a meeting and said something that made a difference in my life. I remember Tom Wilson told me something at the yard that I remember to this day that changed my outlook on everything. And I've seen around our group, I've seen, you know, John load up Ronnie's stuff and move him to Sacramento. And 3 weeks later, when he decided he didn't like it, John loaded up his truck again with a bunch of guys he sponsored and moved him back down. And I saw everybody gather for Kenna and Mike's wedding in Clancy's backyard. And what a great day that was. And what a wonderful experience that was for all of us. And I watched as people gathered around Sharon and Casey as Casey transitioned. And I remember when Charles lost his son, and I stood there and I watched as people in our group formed a line and waited almost 2 hours to give Charles a hug and express their condolences and share in their grief, his grief. And you heard Patrick tonight. He said he could feel us. He could feel the Pacific Group when he lost his father. And that's love. That's love. And when there's love like that, there's the undeniable presence of God. I remember hearing the priest at Charles's church, and he said something that has always stuck with me. He said, to love another is to see the face of God. And so that's what I've learned here. I've learned here that these 12 steps are a way to that maybe I can free myself enough of this self-centeredness that has plagued me my entire life so that I can care about others. I can learn to love someone else so that I can have a conscious contact with God and I can know peace. I have a long way to go in understanding God. You know, I confuse this idea of God as I understand him with understanding God. And I don't know if I ever will understand God. I will tell you this, though. I remember Mike S. spoke a few years ago at our meeting. And he told this story about a woman in the program he met that told him that she was suffering from a terminal illness. And she said, does that make you angry with God? And she said, no, Mike. She said, I think God's sad too. And that really struck me. I'm not sure I really understand the meaning of that, but I believe it to be true. You know, when I had the chance to talk at Clancy's memorial, I talked about him having lived a life of consequence. And I don't mean to say in any remote way that I've lived a life of the magnitude or impact of Clancy. But that's what I aspire to. I aspire to try to work these 12 steps the best that I can. And some days I do it pretty well, and other days not so much. But I am aspiring to, when one day, when it's all said and done, that I have lived a life of consequence. You know, if you're new, welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're so glad that you're here. You know, the holidays can be a difficult time, but they don't have to be. It's not mandatory that you go into a depression over Christmas and Hanukkah and New Year's. It's not. We're here. We have meetings from noon until night. We've got Bagel Fest and we got New Year's shows. I mean, come join us. Come join us. You know, our family, we have a family slogan, and it's fortune favors the bold. And we will share that with you. Be bold. Be all in. Join without hesitation. As my friend Frank Jones used to always say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Merry Christmas and God bless.
We celebrate AA birthdays at this meeting. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, anything which would affect you from the neck up. If your regular attender of this meeting would like to take a cake with us, please email our scribe, Ann P., at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Happy holidays, everybody. My name's Ann. I'm an alcoholic.
Please email her by 6:30. Otherwise, you have to wait until the following week to get recognized. We have several birthdays tonight, and tonight we have a special singer to sing us a happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear AA. Happy, happy birthday to you. You're coming back.
Bam, she drops the mic. We have a custom of, let's read the birthday list here. I'm going to shrink this down. Our first birthday is for Joe T. for 2 years. His sponsor is Rich B. We have a 6-year birthday for Kimberly S. Her sponsor is Linda L. Lexi S. for 7 years. Her sponsor is Leslie E. Steve S. for 10 years. His sponsor is Tom B. Shaler V for 11 years. His sponsor is Roy A. Bridget B for 38 years. Her sponsor is Marilyn S. She had 6 birthdays for a total of 74 years, the average being 12.33 years. Happy birthday, everybody. We have a custom of the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cakes at the end of the year. This money is our contributions to AA organizations worldwide. If you'd like to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H. at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org.
Hello, everyone. As is tradition, tonight we would like to present the Pacific Group Orchestra.
Oh, the human voice is wonderful, but it lacks a full-blown ring. So we brought an entire orchestra for our Christmas caroling.
The fiddles, they sway it, they sing as they say it. The fiddles, they sway it, they sing as they sway. The clarinet goes do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-det. The clarinet goes to a do a do a dead. The clarinet, they sway it, goes to a do a do a do a dead. The clarinet, goes to a do a do a dead.
The horns, they shout it out. The horns, they shout it out.
The clarinets, they sway it, they sing a do a do a dead. The clarinets, they sway it, they sing a do a do a
dead. The drums have no trouble, just double, dub, double. 5-1, 1-5, boom, 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 boom.
The clarinets, they sway it, they sing a do a do a dead.
Let's go
trump, la 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 bassoon, it makes a point of counterpoint. La 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 la.
The trumpet, 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 the
now we have an orchestra from fiddle to bassoon. We've taken some rehearsal time to sing for you on Zoom. Practice what?
Quartet.
A Haydn fugue.
A Schubert symphony.
Ah, don't be ridiculous.
We got better things than that.
Come and see our old PG, which is the place we want to be, to bring to you and sing to you a song that's from our hearts.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.